Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's very special event. I'm Asheem Singh, Director of the Economy Team here at the RSA. And many of the programmes I lead focus on the future of work, on artificial intelligence, on tech, and on citizen empowerment. So it's with great pleasure that I welcome you here for today's event that touches upon some of the key challenges we face as an economy and as a society in future. We're here to discuss Carl's brand spanking new book, The Technology Trap. I've read it, and I've enjoyed it very much, although some questions, which I'll put to Carl later. In this book, Carl reflects on the impact of technological revolutions on work from the past to the present. He considers some of the winners and losers of mechanization, the computer revolution, it's like something from the 70s, and automation. About Carl, he's an economist, an economic historian and author, and he directs the Future of Work program at Oxford University. He's also a senior fellow at the Institute for New Economic Thinking at Oxford and in the Department of Economic History at Lund University. So join me, if you will, in welcoming Carl to the stage to talk about his book, The Technology Trap.
Thank you very much for that generous introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here with you today. Now, the purpose of my book is trying to shed some light on the times that we are living in now through the lens of history. And one point in particular that I'm trying to make is that technology has progressed enormously over the past 200 years, but the debate surrounding its effects has not. And we are now living through another period of automation and anxiety. And this is something that has featured in various points in history. Back in 1929, for example, the New York Times published this article on the fate of the lamplighters. So since the 1500s, lamplighters had been an occupation that featured in most neighborhoods and was an institution alongside the local police and the post office. But with the electrification of city lights, they were threatened, and lamplighters disappeared over a matter of just a few decades. Now, even the lamplighters mostly willingly agreed that electrification of light had its virtues. But that didn't keep them from resisting a threat to their jobs. And in Brussels, for example, lamplighters took the streets and rioted against the spread of electric light. Now, there's been a tendency to ridicule people that resist new technologies. And when I was an undergrad in economic history, I was told that the very last thing we should worry about is machinery and technology taking people's jobs, because economic growth was stagnant for millennia and only actually took off with the first machine age, with the introduction of machinery in production that allowed us to produce much more with fewer people. Now, that is not to suggest that economic activity was completely stagnant prior to then, and there was a lot of inventions before then. But there were very few machines that actually were used in production. And it is indeed those machines that allowed us to produce more with fewer people. And as a result of that, people are roughly 40 times richer today, adjusted for inflation, than they were in 1750. Now, you might ask, how much does it make sense even to compare incomes in 1750 with incomes today? Because the consumer basket that you can purchase for your income is very different today than it was back then. So people during the early days of the Industrial Revolution can only look after the lives of the wealthy in envy, who had servants to do the most tedious things for them. Today, all of us here have access to the electric servant in terms of dishwashers, washing machines, vacuum cleaners, and so on, that relieve us of a lot of tedious work. not to mention antibiotics and automobiles. And indeed, technology has had a tremendous equalizing effect in terms of our consumption possibilities as well. And if that wasn't enough evidence of progress, consider the fact that earning those higher incomes and producing those new goods and services has become much more comfortable as well. At the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, a lot of people work in coal mines. They didn't see daylight for weeks. Cave-ins and explosions were part of everyday working life. Lung disease often came as part of the work package. Today, the majority of us work in air-conditioned offices. I think the hardest day in recent memory at the Oxford Martin School was when the coffee machine broke down, and I think you need to put things in perspective. So I think the long-run story of mechanization is clearly one that has benefited us all. Unfortunately, I think it's also only half of the story. Now, the Industrial Revolution is essentially what laid the foundations for the modern world. And I think it's interesting just to take a step back and think about what people actually said and thought at the time. So Benjamin Disraeli, for example, before he became Prime Minister of Britain, published a novel called Coningsby in 1848, in which one character remarks that I see cities peopled with machines. Certainly Manchester must be the most wonderful place of modern times. The very same year, Frederick Engels published his Conditions of the Working Classes in England, which was written during a stay in precisely Manchester. And Engels had a very different take on the matter. He argued that machinery only serves to downgrade people, takes people's jobs, and puts downward pressure on workers' wages. Now, we all know that he was wrong about the future, but he was actually fairly on target about the period he observed. Because even as the British economy took off, wages were stagnant and probably even falling at the lower end of the income distribution. And if you look at biological indicators of well-being such as heights, you find that the people born in 1750, or the cohorts born in 1750, were actually taller than the ones born in 1850. So there's some evidence to suggest that people's nutrition was adversely impacted during this period as well. The long-run tendency that took place over this period of time was the replacement of the artisan shop with child labor in the factories. And indeed, early spinning machines were specifically designed to be tended by children. And a puzzle to economists and economic historians is therefore, why would men who held well-paid artisan jobs voluntarily have agreed to participate in the industrialization process if it reduced their utility? The simple answer to that is that they did not. They petitioned to Parliament to block the introduction of labor-saving technologies, and they rioted against the mechanized factory. And while much public attention has focused on the Luddite riots in particular, they were just part of a very long wave of riots that swept across Britain, Europe, and even China. And I think it's also important to remember, to borrow the words of the historian Eric Hobsbawm, that what began with the construction of the first factories and ended with the construction of the railroads also ended with the publication of the Communist Manifesto. A lot of revolutionary technologies brought a lot of political revolutionaries along the way. Now, the point is not to predict a socialist revolution, but I think that it's noteworthy that levels of income inequality has been approaching levels not seen since the first industrial revolution. And the income distribution is shaped by a variety of factors, but technology is clearly one of them. And this time around, it's not textile machinery or steam power, it's the cheapening of computers. Now, the first electronic computer was invented at the University of Pennsylvania in 1946. But it consisted of roughly 18,000 vacuum tubes. It weighed 30 tons. And as a result of that, it didn't have any impact whatsoever on the labor market. It took the microprocessor and the personal computer for actually computers to be adopted on a mass scale. And this had two key effects. First of all, it allowed businesses to restructure the supply chains in ways that they could take advantage of cheap labor in countries like China. And secondly, it allowed businesses to automate a lot of routine repetitive tasks, in particular jobs that used to be done in the manufacturing industry. And as a result of this, if you look at the wages, and this is data from the United States, trends are less pronounced in Europe, but you see sort of similar pattern of the disappearance of middle-income jobs. And if you look at the wages of prime-aged men with no more than a high school degree, who would have flocked into the factories before the age of robots, their wages have actually been falling in real terms for four consecutive decades now. It's not just a question of rising inequality. Some groups have seen their earnings capacity being reduced in the labor market. Now, one of my favorite lines from the book is that if you put one hand in the freezer and the other on the stove, you should be feeling quite comfortable on average. But we know from experience that that is not the case. And that same can be said about the state of the labor market, right? And unemployment rate in the United States is around 3.6%, I believe, as I speak. But there's considerable variation across space. And where most of America's problems are is also where most of the robots are. And there are more robots in Michigan alone than there is in the entire American West. So it's been very much a localized phenomenon. And I think that if you want to understand why three key Rust Belt states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, which had opted for the Democratic candidate in every election since 1992, all of a sudden ended up opting for Donald Trump, deindustrialization, globalization, and automation is clearly a key part of that story. And we have already seen a backlash against globalization, but we haven't seen the same resistance to automation, at least not yet. And that is exactly the point. We have seen nothing yet. Most people today work in non-traded sectors of the economy. They're actually relatively shielded from future globalization, but they aren't that shielded from automation. And as artificial intelligence is becoming more pervasive, the potential set of jobs and tasks that can be automated is expanding quite rapidly. Now, the driver of this is big data and the fact that we leave a lot of digital trails when we interact online, which is sort of giving machine learning the fuel it needs to actually reproduce our interactions. And that is what's driving roughly everything from Google Translate to autonomous advances in autonomous vehicles. Somewhat oversimplified, but I think it sort of captures the essence of what is going on. And obviously, you might say that Google Translate, I used it yesterday, it's not great, is it? And autonomous vehicles, where are they? But I think it is important to remember that every revolution in technology has started with imperfect technology. And the early steam engines were merely used to drain coal mines, and even that they didn't do particularly well. But eventually, as they become more energy efficient, they became the prime drivers of the first industrial revolution. And I think that we're actually underestimating the potential scope of automation for a variety of reasons. One is that machines doesn't have to be perfect to actually be implemented. They just need to be as good as us or better, which is not that hard in some domains because we are far from perfect. We respond badly to poor nutrition, a bad night of sleep, and so on and so forth, right? And this is a study of Israeli judges and their decision-making during the day. And you can see that in the morning when they had their snack, right, and insulin levels are high, they make a very high share of favorable decision, which then sort of drops off during the morning, bounces back up again after breakfast and lunch, and so on. And you know, this is not just Israeli judges that are affected by this, we all are. And secondly, I think that there is often a perception that for machines to replace us, they need to reproduce exactly what we do in our jobs. But we didn't automate away the jobs of lamplighters by building robots capable of climbing lampposts. And we didn't automate away the jobs of laundresses by building robots that could walk out of the home, you know, chop down trees, carry buckets of water and piles of wood into the home, heat the water on the stove, and then perform the motions of hand washing. We couldn't even build a robot capable of doing that today. We did so by inventing the electric washing machine, which does an entirely different set of motions, but in the end achieves the same thing, although probably a lot better than I would do hand washing, at least. That being said, the story of the book is not that machines are going to take all the jobs and all, you know, half of us will be left unemployed. There are still bottlenecks to automation, and machines still perform very poorly in certain tasks. To take one example, which is complex social interactions, I think the state of the art is best described by Turing test competitions, where chatbots try to convince human judges of them being a person. And some people argued a couple of years ago that there was a breakthrough because one chatbot actually managed to convince 30% of human judges of it being a person. But it did so by pretending to be a 13-year-old Russian orphan boy with no understanding of English culture, speaking English as his second language, right? And if you think about the variety of much more complex social reaction that we do in person, and this is basic text communication, it gives you sort of some feeling for how far machines are off in reproducing complex social interactions today. The same is true with creativity and perception and manipulation tasks. Now, a key question is then of how intensive jobs actually are in tasks that correspond to these key bottlenecks to automation. What our research suggests, and this is joint work with Michael Osborne at Oxford University, is that roughly 47% of jobs in the US context, similar shares in the UK, are not very intensive in such tasks. And that is jobs in administration, transportation logistics, construction, retail, and so on and so forth. So to take just one example, there are roughly 3.5 million cashiers in the United States today. If you go to an Amazon Go store, you won't see a single one. Now, when we published this paper a couple of years ago, we also published a list of 702 occupations and their relative exposure to automation. And you can imagine that a lot of people went through this list and looked, well, that's silly, right? You can't automate fashion models. That's completely unfeasible. These fashion models here actually don't exist. They've been generated by what's called generative adversarial networks through thousands of pictures, and they have their own Instagram accounts, and they're already being used, and they're doing just fine. Now, I think that if we actually just look at the replacement effect, though, the jobs that are potentially automatable, we actually miss a lot of stuff because we miss all of the sort of second and third order effects. So, for example, when electricity arrived, what factory owners did in the early days of electrification was that they just replaced the steam engine with an electric motor as the central power source in the factory. And as a result of that, all these sort of shafts and countershafts you see there actually remained intact in the factory, and they sort of posed a constant threat to workers' fingers, arms, and lives. And it took a while for people to figure out that, well, you can actually equip every single machine with its own electric motor, and then you can sequence the machinery according to the natural flow of production, which eventually gave rise to mass production. It was allowed Henry Ford to produce the T model at a sufficiently low price for it to become people's vehicles. And this approach to producing things then gradually spread across industries and eventually gave a massive boost to productivity growth. And I think that we can see the same things with artificial intelligence and advanced robotics, but it's going to take some time for us to figure out actually how to do things. That is if businesses are actually allowed to do it. Because I mentioned earlier, resistance to technological change has been widespread in history. And I think a big difference between the first industrial revolution and now is that ordinary people actually have some political voice. The Luddites were politically disenfranchised. Property ownership was still a requirement for voting. And as a result of that, people had a very limited political clout. And I think that the economist Leontief was onto something when he suggested that if horses could have joined the Democratic Party and voted, what happened on the farms might have turned out differently. They may have used their political voice to bring the spread of the tractor to a halt. And we're already seeing some examples of this. Recently, dock workers in Los Angeles Harbor went on strike over the fears of autonomous cargo trucks. Truck drivers in the state of Missouri are now demanding legislation that will block the introduction of autonomous trucks on the highways. And more broadly, a majority of Americans now actually think that there should be restrictions on the number of machines businesses should be allowed to implement. Bill de Blasio recently came out in the United States and said that, well, there should actually be procedures that companies need to submit their automation plan to worker council, which then has to approve that, sort of raising further the cost of automation. And indeed, when I began writing this book 5 years ago, proposals to tax robots wasn't on the agenda. Now it's featuring in the public debate on both sides of the Atlantic. A key point of the book is that the future of technological progress and economic growth actually depends a lot on what people believe. And if people think that they are going to benefit from this over the short, medium, and long term, people are likely to willingly accept automation. But if they don't think so, they are much more likely to resist it. And one of the key points is that the reason that the first industrial revolution actually happened in Britain was that for the first time in Britain, governments actually sided with innovators and pioneers of industry rather than angry workmen. The craft guilds, which persisted all across Europe up until the 19th century, had no interest in any machinery being implemented that threatened their skills and incomes, and fearing social unrest, government typically sided with the guilds. My selling proposition for the book is usually, if you want to learn about what governments actually can do to make the transition more smooth, you have to buy the book. It's a great gift for family and friends, and thank you for your attention.
I must follow those artificial intelligence models on Instagram. I think that's going to be my first order of business after this. That was really interesting, thank you. And I suppose, you know, what I was really struck, Carl, by one of your early slides where you sort of said, well, we've seen nothing yet in terms of the impact, the political impact, the social impact. I really wanted to focus on some of the responses from on a policy level that are happening or that could happen or should be happening right now. So the first concept that I wanted to touch on is Ludditism. The idea of being a Luddite, it's a term of abuse, it's sort of something in our current vernacular that we see as a really, it's not something you want to be classed as. And yet, your book, actually, the idea of Ludditism, it's actually demonstrated to be a sort of almost a shadow counterpart to all iterations of automation over the ages. This idea that there is a social justice question that underpins mechanization and automation. And throughout history, different forces have stepped forward to play that role. In China, it's the government who is saying, look, we're going to side with the workers here. You've got this great anecdote from Pliny where, if I can find it, during the reign of the Emperor Tiberius, Pliny the Elder tells a story of a man who had invented unbreakable glass And instead of rewarding the inventor for its creativity, Tiberius had the man executed in fear of the possibility of angry workmen rebelling. So there have always been these people who've played these roles. I suppose I wonder, who do you think in our society is playing that Luddite role? And are they playing it for good or for ill?
I think that's a great question. So far, in most countries, you haven't seen much outright resistance to mechanization. And I think part of the reason for that is that over the course of the 20th century and over the course of the late 19th century, people sort of saw the benefits of automation and mechanization in terms of rising wages, in terms of shorter working hours, in terms of more holidays, in terms of access to more goods and services. And people in the early 19th century didn't even think that mechanization could improve the human lot, right? Economists broadly agreed on this. So Malthus, Ricardo, Marx, all very different people, one thing that they agreed on was that mechanization could not improve people's wages. And the late 19th century eventually proved them wrong. And people, you know, had this experience of the 20th century now under their belt. But I think it's a mistake to assume that that is always going to persist, especially if certain groups experience sort of very persistent wage declines in the labor market for a long period of time. And I think most economists think that the purpose of production is consumption. But we actually know that that is not the case because people attach a lot of meaning to their work. One of the most consistent findings across countries and different periods of time is that people who work are happier than those who don't. If you look at communities where jobs have disappeared due to deindustrialization, you see worsening health outcomes, you see faltering marriage rates, you see rises in crime, a lot of social ills associated with that. So even though people's consumption possibilities have arguably improved because we have access to so many more goods and services and have vastly more comfortable lives and jobs today, even so, there is a group in society who haven't reaped the benefits from this in the labor market, and they are sort of very much showing their discontents. That has primarily led to backlash against globalization and so forth, but automation has had very similar effects.
So do you think there's scope for more Ludditism? Or do you think we're creating the conditions because for a movement that has the velocity and the anger that the original Luddite movement had? You know, that the government of Lord Liverpool responded to the Luddite movement by, you know, essentially hanging about, was it 32 of them? Or, you know, I get the precise number wrong, but it was, you know, and the reason given was these are enemies of the state. These are people who are acting contrary to the development of the British economy. And so there was a massive and violent state backlash, if you like, against the Luddite movement. But do you think there is enough anger being fomented? Or do you think there's scope for a movement of that velocity and that anger to emerge in our society?
Well, I'm not a fan of either Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, but I don't see either of them actually hanging people trying to resist mechanization. Joke aside. So I think, broadly speaking, we are unlikely to see the same type of resistance to mechanization because we have other mechanisms of showing our discontent. So in terms of voting rights, in terms of, you know, labor unions, although people have become increasingly detached from them. And in addition to that, it's much harder to smash an algorithm than a textile machine for purely physical reasons. But I do very much fear that as people realize that globalization is not the key reason of many of their concerns, the jobs are not going to come back, even though the US is hiking up tariffs. The rise of China has already happened. Most people work in non-traded sectors of the economy, and those non-traded sectors are increasingly being affected too by automation. The political target could potentially shift, and that is one of the key points of the book.
Interesting. And I suppose, you know, I mean, I hesitate to say this, but you know, we are in the middle of an election period, and you did just mention two of the protagonists in that election. So while as a charity with all that carries, we're not going to get behind any particular candidate or endorse any particular candidate in the course of this. I am interested. I mean, there's an election in the US next year as well. I am interested in what you think the current cleavages are in British and or American politics. And what I mean by that is whether you think there are particular politicians or particular political movements currently in operation that get it, that get what you're talking about, that get the immense challenge and the immense socioeconomic challenge posed by automation, whether that's here or whether that's over in the US.
I think what has happened is if you look at the post-electoral surveys in the 50s and 60s, you see that high-income voters in Britain, in Germany, in France, and in the US are typically associated with the political right. You see that low-income, low-education voters are more associated with the political left. Beginning in the 70s and 80s, you see that the political left becomes much more associated with high education voters, while political right remains more associated with high income voters. And what this means is essentially that what we call the old working class has become increasingly detached from mainstream political parties. And they've also become increasingly detached from labor unions, not just because they are in decline, but the unions are also increasingly representing a more sort of skilled part of the workforce. And I think that the populists are very sort of effectively tapping into their anger, and that is what's happening both in Britain and the United States.
So you've got the populist sort of... The populist, if you like, movement are very effectively activating and triggering, to use their favourite term, people's latent or nascent concerns about this stuff that hasn't even been fully realised because, you know, the full picture is still emerging. And do you think there are any, you know, I would sort of call that a fairly negative approach to dealing with this, you know, a fairly sort of self-serving approach. But do you think there are any political figures, who really are taking a more positive approach and actually are coming up with ideas or are soliciting ideas that can actually help us create a better society through these changes? Like who's doing this well? Who's responding to these challenges well, would you say, as opposed to effectively, which I suppose the populist right are doing so effectively, but whether they're doing it well, it's an open question, but you know.
Well, I don't see any particular country which has a plan that is specifically tailored to address the concerns surrounding automation. You see Andrew Yang running on an anti-automation platform in the United States for the time being. You see Bill de Blasio discussing the introduction of robot tax. Jeremy Corbyn has raised the issue in some instances as well. The robot tax, I think, is absolutely the wrong response. So it's not a positive example. But, you know, I'm not a mind reader. It may be that some people do really get it and have a plan that sort of they think can credibly address this, but are not necessarily discussing it with regard to automation. So in Sweden, where I'm from, I find it striking that when Fredrik Reinfeldt lost the election a number of years ago, it wasn't a single reference to automation and trends in the labour market during the entire election campaign. When he lost, his first speech was actually about the changes in the labour market and the challenges facing mainstream political parties as a result of that. And you may wonder why I didn't raise it during the campaign.
Why not a robot tax, just out of interest? What are the policy arguments against that from your perspective?
Well, I mean, one issue is just defining what's a robot. So, I mean, is a self-service checkout a robot? Is an algorithm a robot? And so on. Secondly, you want robots to be adopted to increase productivity growth, right? If you've adopted a tax on tractors in the early 1900s, most people would have worked on the farms for much longer. They're less likely to have shifted into more productive sectors of the economy. Growth would have been much slower. New sort of goods and services wouldn't have been produced to the same extent. In general, you want to tax things that you want less of, not more. Now, I think that there is an argument to, you know, as the labor share of income is falling, to maybe tax capital a bit more and labor a bit less, or try to close the gap. But I don't see a reason why you should sort of single out robots, which is a sort of productive equipment in production.
I mean, from everything you've been saying so far, you know, we've seen nothing yet. You seem to be fairly skeptical about the quality of the political class and the political agenda in terms of responding to the huge challenges. It seems almost that you're advocating for a sort of a new economic model or a new political agenda to kind of deal with some of the epochal issues, you know, the issues raised by what others have called the fourth industrial revolution. And I wonder, do you see any scope in the current political landscape for that happening? I mean, the only thing I can think of that is radical, well, there are two really radical forces in British politics at the moment. The first thing is the climate crisis movement and the rise in interest in kind of slow growth models and in this new kind of post-growth economic thinking. And then the second thing, this is a controversial one, is Brexit. And this is definitely not a cri de coeur in favour of Brexit. I think that's going to necessarily go down well on this stage. But it does strike me that it almost feels like what you're saying is that our response is nowhere near at the level required yet, because, quote, we ain't seen nothing yet.
Right. So...
Discuss.
So first of all, I think there's a tendency to think that we have this big challenge and we need, you know, one big solution, and that solution must be basic income. And one thing I try to argue for in my book is that there is no one solution. There is a number of things that can be done that collectively amount to something that can make a big difference. But you know, if you have 2 minutes to lay out your argument, you're not going to be able to go through all of them. And I think, you know, in a world that increasingly focuses on sound bites, that is not a very compelling argument to make. Now, I'm not of the view that we need to rethink everything from scratch, and we need a new economic model. I'm an economist by training, which means that I'm also not necessarily the most creative person. And I do, as an economist, also believe in the division of labor. And I, you know, subscribe to the view that there are more creative people elsewhere which can sort of think about that part. But I actually think that there are a lot of things we can do to ease the relocation of people between places, which I think has become a huge issue. That there's a lot of things that we can do to ease the movement between occupations, retrain people, provide better social safety nets for people that sort of fall through the cracks. Just to give one sort of fairly conventional example, so where I grew up in southern Sweden, in Lund, is a city close to Malmö. Malmö was a city that specialized in building ships, and the shipyard was closed down in the early 1990s, and the city was doing really badly for a long time. And essentially up until the point where the bridge was constructed to Copenhagen. And all of a sudden, people could stay put in Malmö, where housing was cheap, commuting to Copenhagen, which offered an abundance of well-paying jobs. Most of those people would spend most of the money locally, which gave a boost to the local service economy. And that sort of created the virtuous cycle. And, you know, for all the bad press Malmö is getting in Fox News and all places, it's actually, you know, in a much better place. I think that, you know, by connecting declining places and expanding ones, a lot can actually be achieved, because the story is not one where, you know, we see mass unemployment. It is one of growing disparities between cities and regions, and I think that is something that we need to bridge.
Before we go out to Q&A, I just want to ask you one more question, a slightly different tack. There are a few people in the audience here who work at the RSA's Future Work Centre. I know they would absolutely kill me if I didn't ask this question, so bear with me. And it's about predictions. I think it's fair to say that you first rose to public consciousness to the extent that you have with your 2013 paper with Michael Osborne, which was actually, I noticed one of the slides, the gentleman, the protester was holding up your statistic, which for an academic must be one of the most amazing examples of impact that you can possibly see. But that 47% of American jobs are at risk of automation, and this was treated, I think it's fair to say, you became something of a Svengali, a soothsayer in the media as a result of that. And it's been fantastic watching your career develop over the last few years and seeing how you've embraced that. But you know, one of our sort of touchstones at the RSA Future Work Centre, and everyone is making predictions. Now, you were the trailblazer, but everyone's making, I think MIT counted 18 separate automation predictions from sources as varied, you know, from universities, from McKinsey, from Deloitte, from PwC. And in terms of our action research and the work we do with workplaces at the Future Work Centre, with employers, with regulators, we find that predictions are a less than useful tool often to put people in frames where they can make policy together and respond to some of the challenges that are happening in their workplaces, communities. And I also noted that you've actually, in certain things that you've said post that 2013 research drop, you said, well, I wasn't actually predicting. Actually, I was just merely making a few observations about susceptibility to automation, but it wasn't predictions. I'm not a soothsayer. So I wonder what your reflections are on predictions, on people who make predictions, and the utility of predictions within the automation debate.
Sure. So I think if you get the present right, and if you get the history right, you probably get about 90% right, maybe 85. I'm not entirely sure. That was not a prediction. I mean, what we did in the 2013 paper was looking at the potential scope of automation, right? So you take the current pie of employment. You know, are these jobs intensive in tasks that, you know, are hard to automate or not? And that is, you know, an estimate. It is not a prediction. So we didn't predict that 47% of jobs in the United States will be automated. We said that 47% of jobs are at high risk of automation from a technological capabilities point of view, but a lot of other factors drive decisions to automate, including relative costs between capital and labor, including worker assistance, including legislation. So even if Google Translate was to become perfect tomorrow, for certain documents, you still require certification from a translator. So unless we certify Google Translate, you know, the jobs of translators are not going to be replaced, and so on. And we have a section on that. I don't know which page, 29 maybe, which nobody probably has read. But that is essentially what the paper says. If you look at some of these reports from Boston Consulting Group or the World Economic Forum, even that, you know, 7 million new jobs will be created by 2030 and 5 million will be replaced. You know, the only thing I can say is they know a lot more than I do, and I don't even know how we could come up with those estimates.
So much more we could talk about that, but I think I've been hogging you for too long. So let's go to let's open this conversation out a bit. There are two ushers with roving mics, I believe, in the audience. So if you'd like to ask questions, do we have a few over here? Oh, there's someone at the back there. Do we have any women who want to ask questions? I prefer to start with a. Oh, is that lady at the back there? So if we start with the lady at the back here, and then we'll move forward.
Thank you very much. Just making it quite personal, you must have young people in your circle. I don't know if you have kids and how old they are, or your friends' kids. What sort of advice do you give to them, especially so many young people, you know, feeling pain out there, and mid-career professionals who are starting to feel the pain because they're being displaced? What sort of things do you tell them?
Well, I think the last lecture I took on macroeconomics at when I was an undergrad, I was told that, well, you gathered all of this knowledge, but one thing I would try to stop you from doing is to give too much advice. And he gave a story where he, as a macroeconomist, argued that there was essentially zero chance that Sweden would devalue its currency in the 1980s because we'd just done it twice and it wouldn't happen a third time, and 3 weeks later, the devaluation happened and they lost a lot of money. And you know, being an economist does not necessarily mean that you are best placed to give people advice. But look, I think that for young people that are entering the labor market now, their situation is very different from if you're 55 and you know you lost your job in manufacturing industry and need to start all over again. And I think young people still have very much the opportunity to choose their career path. They haven't invested a lot of resources into accumulating a particular skill set. So I think it's actually a lot harder on people later in life. But overall, I try to make analysis, but not give too much personal advice.
I think there are two more hands. There's a hand up over here. There's a hand up at the front here. We've got a question online over here. This is great. Sorry, two questions online. Okay, let's take this question over here first, and then we'll go to the online questions.
Hello. I read your book and I really enjoyed it. One of the narratives I really liked was the way within manufacturing, how when the machinery became more complicated, the workers could demand a higher wage, even if they didn't have many skills to begin with. In the new computer age, do you see the potential for low-skilled workers to be able to demand higher wages once the technology was more developed?
Right. So I think, your bargaining power essentially very much depends on your outside options. So if you have, you have a PhD in machine learning, you're in demand everywhere and your bargaining power is very, very high. If you used to work on an assembly line and you see all of those jobs moving to China or being automated away, your bargaining power is going to be quite low. In addition to that, if you look like a country of Sweden, which has where workers are still relatively unionized, we still have the Swedish Confederation of Industry and the union setting the mark in terms of the lowest the floor for wage increases over the next couple of years. That obviously, increases workers' collective bargaining power. So institutions do matter as well, but the historical evidence overwhelmingly suggests that if technology is of replacing type and it reduces your skill sets, even the unions can't do that much. And the lamplighters union disappeared with the electrification of city light. The switchboard operators union disappeared as those jobs were automated away, and so on and so forth.
So a lot of what wages that earners can use, the workers can earn, depends on the how technology affects the balance between capital and labour. Is that how you see it?
Well, it depends on people's bargaining power and outside options, which depends on their outside options, which can depend on political institutions and so on.
We have two questions from Twitter here, I think. So if we could have those, and then we'll go back to the audience.
So the first question is from Nico McDonald, and he says, where does agency fit into your model? When you talk about machinery taking people's jobs, do you consider machines, computers to have agency, or is this the domain of people, capitalists, politicians, citizens, and workers? And then the second question, maybe just for time, it says, Carl described building pressures from globalization and automation and the associated alienation of labor. Do you have a view of how our democracies should respond? Tax and redistribute, resistance, UBI, I'm guessing maybe not, or trust the future?
So start with agency, I guess.
I don't see how do machines have agency. I've never really understood that. I mean, maybe somebody in the audience may disagree to me and tell me why I'm wrong, but I don't really see that. With regard to policy responses, well, I think there are a host of things. So I think one thing for people living in London is that, housing here is extremely expensive. It makes it hard for people on lower incomes to actually move into and live where the jobs are happening, are appearing. And it also means that the prime beneficiaries of this clustering of new jobs is also going to owners of real estate. And I think, you know, we need to sort of consider many of these zoning restrictions, which makes it more expensive to move. We need to build a lot more where new jobs are actually emerging, because one of the main reasons that productivity growth has been slow, that wages are falling behind and that inequality is rising, is that a lot of people can't actually participate in the local economies where growth is happening because of costs of housing and because there are bad commuting links into the places where the jobs are. So I think that is one area. There's a lot of, you know, occupational licenses that we could look into, which are making it very, very costly for people to move between different occupations. So in the US, for example, if you want to be a hair shampooer in the state of Tennessee, you need to sit two exams. If you then want to move to North Carolina, you need to sit another exam because it's not even harmonized across space, right? So we need to rethink that as well. You know, when I go home to Sweden, I do find that people are less concerned about automation than they are in the United States. And, you know, maybe if you lose your health insurance with your job, you have more reason to be concerned. So, you know, there are things that can be done in that area as well.
Do you think that's because of the infrastructure, the kind of the economic security of individual workers in Sweden is better catered for than in perhaps in the more Anglo-Saxon economies, and so that fear isn't there so much because of that the strength of that?
Yes, I mean, in part, so if you have a more compressed income distribution, right, if you lose the middle-income jobs and was forced to switch into another job and accumulate new human capital in that job, if the income distribution is more compressed, your fall is going to be less significant. So, that may play a role, but also, I mean, I think it makes sense for things like health insurance, if you lose your job and still have access to that, it's not as harsh if you lose your health insurance with your job, for example.
Sure. Can we take one more round of questions? There's a gentleman over here.
Excuse me, there's a gentleman back here as well.
Oh, there's a gentleman back there as well. Great, thank you. So we'll start with this question here, then we'll do the questions, then we'll take a response in kind. Thanks.
Hello?
Yeah, please speak into the microphone. Thank you.
Okay. It seems as a species we've been incredibly clever in projecting the abilities of mechanics and electronics in doing all the tasks that we would normally do ourselves, so that we've run ahead. I don't know whether your book covers this or not, but while now our abilities are way ahead of our facility, so we don't need as many people. Do you think that eventually we'll start cutting down on the number of people that we require who are unproductive and therefore useless to enable us to have a more productive world?
We'll come back to that. there's a gentleman at the front here. And there's a gentleman in the middle over there. So let's come to this question.
Thanks. Obviously, the politics of this is quite topical in the UK because with the election coming up, I do a fair bit of canvassing and door knocking politically. And it always strikes me how rarely quality of work or work-related issues come up on the doorstep. It's all sort of usually sort of local public services. Immigration crops up a lot, but people seem to think that sort of the forces shaping their working lives are so big and global that it's something that policymakers no longer have any control over. And do you think there's a sort of a sense of resignation over forces like automation, and is there anything that that can be done to make its effects more positive, seem more possible?
Yeah, brilliant. So resignation, and gentlemen very, very patiently waiting over here.
Thank you. Actually, my question is not too dissimilar from the gentleman at the back of the room, but I just want to check, Carl, what you believe in terms of, do you believe that we as a society should be enthusiastically embracing all automation technologies? Or actually, just because we can doesn't mean we should. And therefore, if the latter, how do we decide and who decides?
Brilliant. So would you like a summary or are you good to go?
I think I'm good to go.
Good. So,
well, I think the latter part of your question, who decides, I think is a key one. And No, I think it's hard to have a centrally planned economy that decides what things to automate and what to automate and tries to predict sort of the consequences of that. So a lot of these technologies and their effects are very unpredictable, and a lot of the things we only learn later on have to sort of gradually adjust to. And I think if we introduce such schemes, we are making it much more likely that a lot of technological progress is going to be blocked. I think in general, we have this sort of notion of permissionless innovation. And the more people you need to ask for permission to actually introduce something, the less likely you are to do it. So in general, I'm not sure that every automation technology is good. You can probably come up with some examples that are not. During the Industrial Revolution, nobody thought that CO2 emissions would affect the climate and really lead to global warming and things like that. There's a lot of unintended consequences that we didn't know of. And people had, at the time, really no way of knowing. So, I think that what we need is a sort of flexible economy in which sort of policy is able to adjust, as things happen, but not where you need to ask for more permission to do things. I think that's probably the wrong way forward. With regard to jobs, we could have decided back in 1910, if we wanted to sort of maintain the living standard that we had in 1910, we could today work until April and take the rest of the year off, right? And for some reason, we have not decided to do that. And I think, some of us are, a bit too enthusiastic about the new iPhone and happy to work longer hours because of the quality of improvements in these new products. But overall, I think we are quite happy to work to be able to afford new things. And, there's nothing inherently bad in that, I think. In particular, since a lot of the new things tend to be services, which are less problematic from a climate perspective as well. But I think, there's no right answer to this, and this idea of bullshit jobs is clearly wrong. There's a lot of large-scale surveys that show that people across all sets of occupations put a lot of meaning to their work. Was there another question as well?
Do we need fewer people?
Right.
I think it was one of the questions.
Well, fewer people, if the question is fewer people in work, the answer is no.
And on that note, we are out of time, so suddenly we have to wrap up now. Thank you all so much for coming and for your questions. You will have the opportunity to speak further with Carl and to buy the technology trap in the foyer outside, where Carl, you'll be staying on for a short while to sign copies, is that right? Fantastic. So you can continue these debates there. If you'd like to know more about the RSN, keep up to date with our own efforts to change the world, and indeed with my team's efforts to inaugurate a better future of work and tech for all, please sign up via our website for our events and project newsletters, or indeed, why not head downstairs to our coffee house, Rothmel's, now for lunch or for a coffee. You're very likely to bump into a fellow or member of staff there, and you can find out a little more about our current work and how you can get involved. For now, please join me in once again thanking our fantastic guest speaker for today, Carl Frey.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.